Welcome to the O'Reilly Open Source Convention 1999. Topaz, Perl for the 22nd Century.
This way. Mentioned that the title of this talk was actually Nat Torkington's idea, not mine. It's a cool title, but thank you very much, whoever did that. But there is a point about Topaz that I need to make pretty early. We're going to talk about the infamous five W's and the H first. We're going to start with, beg your pardon? Oh!
Yes, my precious.
What's his got in its pockets is? It's his got as a project. I'm not sure whether that's Gollum or Jar Jar, actually. That's good. That's yes. It's like Jar Jar is Gollum minus all of the interesting character person. But enough Jar Jar bashing. That's way too easy. Topaz is a project to re-implement all of Perl in C++. If it comes to fruition, if it actually works, it's going to be Perl 6. But there is, of course, the possibility that for various reasons, not all of which are under anybody's control, things may change and it may not really work out. So that's why I'm not really calling it Perl 6 at this point, although occasionally I have been known to say it will be fixed in Perl 6. But, you know, I'm just speaking through my hat when I say that. Exactly. There's some chance this could be Perl 7 or Perl 8. It depends on how long we take to finish and how good Sarathy is at keeping Perl 5 going in the meantime. He's doing such a good job, it's making my job a lot harder, but of course, everybody else benefits, so who am I to complain? Who's doing it? Well, it's me mostly for now, because when you're starting on something like this, there's really not a lot of room to fit more than one or two people. Those core design decisions really can't be done in a bizarre fashion with an A, although obviously they can be bizarre with an I. But hopefully they won't be too bad. When the official start was last year's Perl conference, I expected to have something more or less equivalent to Perl 4 by, well, now. That was a little optimistic. Kind of reminds me of Ted Nelson saying that he was hoping that he was expecting the office to be completely run without paper by the mid-70s. And then sometime in the late 70s, he commented on that and mentioned also a commentary by a reporter who said, Is Nelson nuts? I think was the exact phrase. So I guess I was nuts. But well, optimism is a fine thing as long as it doesn't turn to bitterness. I'm not bitter. No. All right. So how will it be done? Well, it's being done in C++, and there are some reasons for that. One of which, of course, is I happen to like C++. But actually, we had the very first discussion/argument on the Perl 6 Porters mailing list was what language to use. We had some runners-up that actually were under serious consideration. Objective-C has some nice characteristics, one, of course, being that it's simple, and with the GNU implementation, it is pretty much available everywhere. Downside is that it has no equivalent of inline functions, so you'd have to resort to heavy use of macros again, which is something that I kind of like to get away from. Also, it doesn't have any support for namespaces, which means that the entire mess we currently have of a separate list of external functions that need to be renamed by the preprocessor during compilation so that you don't conflict with somebody else when you embed it in another program would need to be carried forward. And I really hate that part. I mean, it's well done and everything, but it's just one of those things you wish you didn't have to do. So, you know, being the lazy programmer, it's like, why work harder than you have to? In C++, you solve that problem by saying namespace Perl, open curly brace, and the rest is automatic. So, that is the reason why Objective-C came out of the running. Eiffel actually was a serious contender for a long time until I realized that in order to get decent performance, Eiffel compilers, or I should say the free Eiffel compiler, because there are multiple implementations, needed to do analysis at link time as to all the classes that were actually in the program. Because Eiffel has no equivalent of declaring member functions, I'm using the C++ terminology, declaring them to be virtual or non-virtual. It intuits this by figuring out the equivalent of the Java characteristic final, i.e. I have no derived classes, at link time. And so it says, well, if there are no derived classes, then therefore I can just inline this function call. Which is clever and all. The problem is that Topaz must be able to load classes dynamically at runtime and incorporate them into the class structure. And so obviously anything that depends on link time analysis is right out. So that was the end of Eiffel. Ada, actually as a language, has much to recommend it. Conciseness is not one of them, but it does have some good characteristics, and I do secretly tend toward the bondage and discipline style of programming, i.e. the more you tell the compiler, the more it can help you to enforce the things you told it. However, the only free implementation of Ada, at least the only one I'm aware of, NATS, is written in Ada, which is an interesting design decision, and it obviously helped them. They obviously like Ada, so they use it, right? The problem is that it would require, if Perl 6 were written in Ada, it would require people to bootstrap NATS before they could even get to Perl, which, you know, that's too much of a burden to put on anybody. So, thus, we're left with C++. It's rather like the comment that I believe Winston Churchill is reported to have said about democracy. It's absolutely the worst system except for all the others. So C++ is the worst language we could have chosen except for all the others. So where will it run? The plan is for it to run anywhere that there's an ANSI C++ compiler. And for those of you who've seen the movie, the miniseries Shogun, there's a point where the pilot is supposed to learn Japanese. And if he doesn't learn it, the entire village will be killed. He can't stand the possibility of all these deaths being on his head, so he's about to commit suicide. And finally, the Shogun says, well, whatever you learn, it will be considered enough. And so then he's okay with it. Well, that's kind of how I feel about Visual C++. Whatever Visual C++ implements, we shall call that enough. Because I really don't think that we can ignore Windows as a target market. If nothing else, we need the checklist item, works on Windows. Otherwise, the people who don't understand what's going on will refuse to use Perl in situations where they really need to. So, you know, unless there's an overriding reason why it's absolutely impossible, although we will use ANSI features as much as possible, because ANSI C++ really is a well-done description and a well-done specification for C++ with a few minor things I don't like. Visual C++ is so common, we really just can't afford to ignore it. As for non-Windows platforms, and even for Windows platforms for some people, EGCS, which actually has now been renamed to GCC 2.95, is a really amazingly good implementation of the C++ language. I mean, the kind of bugs, the kind of features that they are working on in the mailing list are so esoteric that actually it takes me two or three times to read through just the description of the bug before I understand it. The basic stuff is no problem at all. So, okay. Now that's really unfortunate. Your screen came back and mine did not. Let's see if I can fix this an easy way. Nope, I'm going to have to look at the screen. Okay. GCC 2.95, the ANSI C++ library for EGCS/GCC is really not all that good at this point, but work is underway on that. I expected them to be more or less done by now. Obviously, they're not. But I still expect them to be done by the next conference. Just that the next conference is now Conference 4.0. By then, I hope that we'll be able to use that library in the Topaz implementation. Now, the big question. Why in the world would I do such a thing? Or rather, start the ball rolling? Well, the primary reason was difficulty of maintenance. Perl's guts are, well, complicated. Nat Torkington described them well. I believe he said that they are an interconnected mass of livers and organs and pancreas and lungs and little sharp pointy things and the occasional exploding kidney. It really is hard to maintain Perl 5. I mean, considering how many people have had their hands in it for how long, it's not surprising this is the situation. And you really need indoctrination in all of the deep mysteries of SVs and magic structures and so on before you can really hope to make significant changes to the Perl core without breaking more things than you're adding. And some design decisions have made certain bugs really hard to get rid of. For example, the fact that things on the stack do not have their reference counts incremented has made it necessary to fake the reference counting in some circumstances, a la the mortality concept, for those of you who've been in there. Really, when you think about it, the number of people who can do that sort of deep work because they're willing to or have been forced to put enough time in to understand it is very limited, and that's bad for Perl, I think. I think it would be better if the barrier to entry to working on the core were lower, because right now the only thing that's really accessible to everyone is the Surface language. So anytime anybody has the feeling that they want to contribute to Perl, the only thing they really feel they know how to do is suggest a new feature, which hopefully, you know, they'll be able to do things like suggest an improvement in efficiency later or something like that that would make, you know, Ilya happy. Secondary reason actually is new features. I mean, there are some features there where the people say, yeah, I'd want that just because it's cool. First of all, dynamic loading of basic types, and I'll give an example of that later. The basic concept is if you want to invent a new thing like a B-tree hash, you shouldn't have to modify the Perl core for that. You should just be able to create an add-on that's dynamically loaded and inserts itself, and then you'd be able to use it. Robust bytecode compilation. Now, in complete honesty, I don't know, I haven't looked at the existing bytecode compilation output, but I do know from examining how the internals work that retrofitting something like that is quite difficult. And if you incorporate into the structure of the op tree, for those of you who know what that is, the basic operations, incorporating into the structure of that and the design of that, the concept of a separation between designing the semantic tree, as in this is what I want, versus designing the runtime representation for efficient execution, once you've made that separation, now you can also have a separate implementation of the semantic tree, which is, say, just a list of bytecodes, which would be easy to write to a file and then read back later. So separation of representing the op tree statically versus what you use dynamically is an important part of that part of the internals. Also, something that could be done currently, but nobody's gotten around to it, is micro Perl. Now, you all, if you've built Perl, you've noticed that there's the main Perl, and then there's mini Perl, which I always expect to have a little price tag hanging off of it. And then there's the concept of micro Perl, which is even smaller than mini Perl. The idea here is, what parts of Perl can you build without any knowledge that Configure would give you? Or perhaps only very, very, very little Configure test. For example, we could assume ANSI, or we could assume pseudo POSIX. I don't know which assumption would be more appropriate. Maybe we'd have to have built-in configurations for either. In any case, even if you limit yourself to ANSI, you've got quite a bit of stuff. You, of course, have all the basic internal data structures in the language. You can make a call to system to spawn children, and a few other things. And that basically gives you Perl as your scripting language. And then you can write the configure in MicroPerl. I don't know about you, but I'd much rather use MicroPerl as a language for configuration than SH, because who knows what particular weird version of SH you're going to have. And really, isn't it kind of a pain to have to spawn an external test program just to see if two strings are equal? Come on. OK, so that's also part of the plan. We could do this with Perl 5. Who knows, maybe now that I've mentioned it, somebody will. But that's also something I have in mind. And that was all that fit on the slide. Shades of Fermat. OK, any questions on this so far, by the way? No? You're all too stunned. OK, yes. Ah, well, that's mostly because of the namespace and macro issue. Yeah, the question was, why not use C? And certainly, C does have a lot to recommend it. But the necessity of using all those weird macros for namespace manipulation, which I'd rather just use the namespace operator for, and the proliferation of macros is also a disadvantage. Stroustrup makes a persuasive argument that every time you can eliminate a macro and replace it with an inline function or a const, declaration or something of that sort, you are benefiting yourself because the preprocessor is so uncontrolled and all of the information from it is lost when you get to the debugger. So, you know, I'd prefer to use C++ for that reason. Yeah?
What's the writing
Perl 6 in Perl 5? Writing Perl 6 in Perl 5. That's an interesting question. Well, actually,
what I mean by that is automatically generate C code or C++ code.
Yeah. And the question is, would it be plausible to use Perl, presumably, of course, Perl 5, to automatically, mechanically generate parts of Perl 6? And the answer is yes, that absolutely will be done. The equivalent of what is now opcode.pl will still exist. And it will be generating a whole bunch of C++ classes to implement the various types of ops.
I've often claimed that the language
attains maturity when it can be implemented itself. Sarathy says that he's often claimed that a language achieves maturity when it can implement itself. Larry would disagree, and I would agree with Larry's disagreement. It all depends on a problem, on the problem domain. I mean, I think a programming language achieves maturity when it can fully meet all of the design criteria of its creator. It really gets back to really how you describe perfection. I mean, would a perfect human be able to, you know, leap tall buildings and go faster than a speeding locomotive? Or faster than a bullet, stronger than a locomotive, whatever. Would that be a perfect human being? No. Human being design specifications don't include that sort of thing. That's just not part of the problem domain for human beings, okay? You know, not getting sick, not dying, you know, having good memory. Those would be perfect human being qualities, at least I think so. Of course, I didn't design humans, so you'd have to ask the designer, really. So a perfect Perl doesn't have systems programming as part of its target problem domain. That's what C++ and C and those other languages are for. Those are systems programming languages. Perl is an application language. And in fact, one of the things that I really found uncomfortable about Eiffel was that it also is really an applications programming language. The whole concept of pointers and pointer arithmetic and memory management, what is the guy's name at Eiffel? Meyer's new book. The chapter on memory management begins with, ideally, we would like to completely forget about memory management. And I thought to myself, well, that's great if you're doing if you're doing applications, but for systems programming, that's nuts. And it's an example of just, you know, what the language is for. I mean, when I was trying to figure out how to be persuasive on the subject, I finally realized that Perl may be competing with Java in the problem space, but when you're writing Perl, implementing the Perl runtime, really what you're doing is something equivalent to writing a JVM. You're writing the equivalent of a Java virtual machine. Now, would you write a JVM in Eiffel? I don't think so. No, so neither would you write the Perl runtime in Java or in Eiffel. So. Yes, it does. But that's actually an argument in C++'s favor. He said that if Eiffel has the equivalent of xsubs, that is, you can call out to C, then he might use it. And yes, that's a reasonable point of view. That certainly is what we would have done probably if I'd picked Eiffel and Eiffel had been able to do the dynamic loading thing. But one of Stroustrup's design decisions, or one of his design criteria, in the Design and Evolution of C++, a marvelous book, he said he needed to make sure that he left no room beneath C++ where C would still be necessary. Otherwise, C++ would not achieve his goal of being the systems programming language. It would be a tool on top of the systems programming language, and he didn't want that. And I kind of like that idea, so it's what I find appealing. Yes? Yeah, the question is whether we could avoid using Visual C++. That is an option. If I ever found a place where Visual C++ had a severe impact on the design, I would certainly consider it. But I'd like to actually ask Sarathy, because he knows better than me, what impact that would have on Windows people if we were to ask them to use a non-Microsoft development tool. Full set of libraries not available. So existing .libs can't be used. But the GNU linker is not capable of reading a .lib?
No, you can actually generate a GNU format lib2.a from the Microsoft
supply. OK. OK, what is the problem? You know, it's interesting. He says the problem is the header files. Well, that actually may turn out to be a good way to go there, because one of the things that has just been added to the development sources of EGCS is a dash MS dash extensions hack that specifically supports things like the structure in structure that they use. So if they manage to do a good job of that, and if the .libs can be converted, then yes, GCC may be a valid way to go even on Windows. And I'd be sure happy if that worked out. So I'll be keeping my eye on that to make sure we don't avoid that if we don't have to. OK, any other question for now? OK. Language changes only when Larry says so. What he has said on this subject is that anything that is officially deprecated is fair game for removal. Beyond that, I really need to leave things as is. He's the language designer. I'm the language implementer, at least for this particular project. Memories of Star Glob IO are still fresh in my mind. I put that in. I'm responsible. It's my fault. Yes, toward the end of working on 5.4, I put in some stuff that did work out nicely, like for each my, and I kind of got a little full of myself, and I decided that I could put that in too. Well, it isn't consistent with the rest of the syntax. It reveals internals of the data structure that really users should never have seen, and, you know, I repent in sackcloth and ashes. So perhaps I'm overreacting a bit, but it seems like a good separation of responsibilities. You know, I've got enough on my plate without, you know, trying to redesign the language. All righty. Oh, Larry is open to suggestions. And in fact, that's an interesting discussion we had recently on P5P, for those of you who aren't on Perl 5 Porters, was the syntax appropriate for declaring variables to give appropriate hints to a hypothetical compiler. Things like, actually, let me show them on the screen so I don't have to, you don't have to use your imagination. Okay, come on. The idea is to say my int, can't type when I'm not looking, $x, or my str, $y. And I thought that those, the int and the str and the num should be suffixes, something like my $x, colon, num. And in fact, that suffix syntax is something that Larry officially has blessed, but just not for this purpose. That's, again, language designer instincts coming to the fore, because something as common as saying that something is a string or a number should not be so hard to type. It should read better. Meanwhile, if you want to declare something as being a reference to a class, was it my dog spot? That's going to work and say that $spot, when it has a defined value, will be a reference to an object of type dog, or at least of a type that is compatible with dog. And the syntax is already permitted in the Perl parser, and it doesn't do very much yet, but that will be more fully implemented in future as well. Many of the detailed aspects of this came about not just springing fully formed from Larry's forehead, but as a result of discussion. So yes, he absolutely is taking suggestions. So any more question there? Okay. Okay. Getting into the internals. Now, if I'd like to ask, how many of you do not know or don't really even know anything about C++? Okay, a fair number. So I'm going to have to explain. Everyone else is lying. Right. Two kinds of people. People who say that they know C++ and the truthful. Okay. C++ is complicated, definitely. Actually, it reminds me, you know, I'm doing this in C++, and I use Emacs. Tom Christensen asked me, Chip, is there anything that you like that isn't big and complicated? So I see C++, Emacs, Perl, Unix, English. No, I guess not. Okay, so the base class of all of the internal classes for user-visible data structures is called value. Now, for those of you who are at least a little bit familiar with the guts of Perl 5, the structure SV actually does double duty in this regard. SV is both a structure that describes a scalar value and, in some ways, the type used internally as a base class for all the other value types. That is a design decision we don't have to carry forward. So value is a base class, and all it knows how to do are things that are universal to all values. Are you defined? I'm not even sure if that's in there anymore. Clear yourself. How many references do you have? Stuff like that. Derived classes from that include scalar, which of course is the I'm a number, I'm a string kind of thing. The aggregate, which is a combination of the interface for array and hash, and there's a reason why those got merged together. I'll get to that in a minute. Code, which represents anything executable. And by the way, we can have separate derived classes for user code versus constant code versus maybe some XS code. There may be some use for deriving that and making it explicit, but that means that there will be an attribute that says, are you constant? And if you are, please give me back the value that's your constant value. So we won't have to have a hack like it currently exists now, where user subroutines have a certain optree, and to find out if it's constant, the internals have to walk the optree and say, hey, does that optree describe exactly one value? Oh, this must be constant. Really kind of a weird hack. A good one, mind you, because it works, but still kind of weird. And then the IO structure, the thing that I revealed, but shouldn't have, that may actually get split up, because there's no particular reason why IO should include both the directory handle and file handle, except perhaps convenience of the implementer. So if it turns out to be convenient to split them, we just might do that. OK, actually, there's a class above value, and that's counted. Just because something is reference counted doesn't necessarily mean it's a value. So the internals of Topaz allow other classes to be reference counted as well using smart pointers. The counted pointer template allows you to declare a type which is an automatic reference counting pointer. You instantiate it, it increments the reference count of what it's pointing at. And when it's destroyed, it decrements the reference count of what it's pointing at. And by the way, I can't believe I forgot this. This is one of the key reasons why I like C++ over either C or Objective-C. Neither C nor Objective-C has automatic calling of destructors when a scope is left. So this will automatically track reference counts 99.9% of the time. Statistics are made up on the spot. No, actually, 99.9% of the time, all of the reference counting will be done automatically simply by virtue of where the counted pointer object is instantiated and where it's destroyed. So hopefully things like the object that got its reference count zero, but there's still a pointer to it, will be very difficult to have happen in Topaz's internals. For convenience, we have scalar pointer, aggregate pointer, and so on. Those are just typedefs for the equivalent template. So just don't be afraid that you have to type counted pointer less than something, something greater than when you're writing your personal extension. You can abbreviate a little more than that. So a question there? Yeah. The question is there any consideration to allowing reference counting to go away in favor of garbage collection? And the answer is no, I haven't really thought about it. But now that you ask the question, it really shouldn't be hard to ifdef that appropriately. Having a typedef like value pointer is actually one of the advantages. You can say ifdef doing some evil experimentation with garbage collection, then typedef value pointer value star, right? And then value pointer semantics are just that of a regular pointer. And none of the code that uses value pointer should even notice, because value pointer arrow something is handled by operator arrow in C++. So it looks just like a regular pointer when you're using it. So it should be a reasonably easy experiment. Yes?
Are you going to do something like weak references?
Weak references will be supported. But they'll be supported using a thing called a watch object, which is OK, for those of you, how many of you know what a magic object is inside of Perl's Guts? OK, a fair number do. Good. Magic objects do a lot of things. That's one of the reasons why they have the name magic. But one of the things that they're useful for is keeping track of when an object disappears. And the idea here is that if you have a weak pointer to an object, the object's reference count should be allowed to fall to zero. But when that happens, the weak reference is informed about it and is forced to undef. So a weak reference doesn't keep an object alive. It just points at it while it is alive. And although many of the behaviors of a magic have been subsumed into the use of virtual functions in C++, there is still that one behavior that still needs to be implemented for other reasons as well. The equivalent of a magic just for purposes of keeping track of what's happening is called a watch object. You can attach a watch to the target. And then when the object is going to be destroyed, the watch informs and says, hey, it's gone. So yeah, weak references can still be supported. Yep. The question was, why not use garbage collection? Is it the asynchronousness of it? And the answer is, unfortunately, the semantics of that are exposed to the user. And there are, I say unfortunately, not because it's a bad thing, but because it limits our choices. Sometimes Perl objects are used like C++ objects in the sense that the destructor is used to clean up resources. You know, the select saver, which, yes, I wrote. OK, it's my fault again. You instantiate a select saver, which temporarily changes your output handle. And then when it's destroyed, it puts the thing back. If you delayed the destruction until later, your output would be going to the wrong place for a while. So you know that kind of thing, it really needs to be visible. Now, of course, there's the question, could we sometimes reference count and sometimes not? And the answer there is, well, if you're going to have the code in there anyway and doing a test anyway, that's actually going to be slower than if you just do it all the time. So you know, it could be, possibly, that a language design decision could be made that, well, we're okay, it's okay to break that. But until that happens, we're pretty much stuck with it. Sarathy's mentioning that if the reference counting were only done on things where there was a user visible destructor, it's sort of then we could handle it. That would be sort of the equivalent of the C standards as if rule. You know, the C standards overall rule as if says all the documentation says what should happen, but if you can get away with actually doing something else, but make it look as if the standard specified thing is happening, go for it. You know, as if you could do that. So the as if rule also applies to Perl. So if we can do something like that, I'm certainly open to it. The trick is, of course, just not to break user code in the process.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sarathy's pointing out that the performance is noticeably better when you get rid of all the reference counting. Still, you know, Larry has pointed out that this really falls under the, you know, sweeping your complexity under somebody else's rug school of benchmarking, because, you know, stuff has to be collected eventually. I'm not saying your results are false. I'm just saying they need to be taken with a grain of salt, because, you know, taking out the one thing and saying, see, it's faster before you've actually replaced it with the other thing is really kind of cheating. You know, it's like, boy, my car goes really fast because I've reduced the weight because I don't have any brakes. You know, well, you know, till you replace it with the new brake system, that's really kind of cheating. And since I have the microphone, I'm allowed to move on. Okay, scalar finality. This is actually kind of a cool thing, because this actually gets to the cleanness of the internals. This is a real structural improvement in the way the internals are implemented. In the current implementation, there's the SV is used as the front-end object for not only regular old scalars, but also tied scalars, for example, or overloaded ones. In Topaz, on the other hand, there's a separation. The abstract base class scalar has another abstract base class underneath it called final scalar. A plain old scalar cannot be asked, are you a reference, are you a number, are you a string? The reason for that is that some scalars are tied, which means that until you call fetch, you don't know what it's going to return. Then the final scalar actually implements a scalar whose contents have a fixed type that does not change unless you call a modification function. So a final scalar would be the base class for the regular old scalars like $i in your program. Meanwhile, the tied scalars are not derived from final. They're derived from up here. So if you want to find out what is going to be returned from a tied scalar, you have to call the base class method final. Final returns a pointer to a final scalar. Now, if it was final already, it just returns a pointer to itself. That's not a problem. It's very fast. But if it was a tied scalar, it returns a pointer to the result returned by the fetch function. Now you are guaranteed to have something that you're allowed to test its type over and over. This is a bit of a problem in Perl's internals, because the concepts of fetch a magical value and conversion based on what its current type is are kind of mixed together. Like the SVIV function both does a magical get and does a conversion from the return type to an integer. Well, what if you want to call the magical get, then test the bits to see whether you got an integer or not, and based on that, do something else? You know, that's kind of hard to do right now. There's certainly no approved interface for it. So a complete separation of the concepts of get versus examine is really going to benefit the internals. Also, it has the benefit, since the final scalar returned by, for example, a fetch, is now something that you have a pointer to and a reference count on, when you are done using it, you decrement the reference count, that's a temporary value and is completely destroyed. This is kind of a subtle point, but if you have a fetch, I'll get to you in a sec, if you have a fetch internally in Perl 5 that returns a huge string, say a 1 megabyte string for being returned from a tied scalar, the current implementation will put that into the SV, which is the front man for the tie, and leave it there indefinitely, because in Perl 5, there's no equivalent to destroying the temporary. It puts it there and it leaves it there because it doesn't know when you're done with it. In Topaz, on the other hand, when you decrement the reference count on the final scalar that you got back from final, that's what you're saying. You're saying you're done with the temporary, and now the temporary can be destroyed. So that's a nice way to clean up after a fetch. Okay, Ben? Okay. Yeah. The question is, what happens if the fetch function from a tied variable returns another tied variable? And the answer is that whatever the return value is from the fetch, the internals in turn call final on that. And then, of course, if it was fancy, then it does something else that's fancy. But if it was plain, it returns a pointer to itself, and you're back. OK, so that's the final part, which is not the final thing I'm going to talk about. So is there's scalar and there's final scalar. So question on that part so far? All righty. Now, derived from final, remember, final scalar maybe could be called plain scalar or regular scalar, because it's the kind of scalar that you deal with $i and $j, right? Derived from that is pool scalar, which is, of course, for creating a pool of scalars for efficient memory management. We'll get more on that later. And then finally, derived from pool scalar is fat scalar, which is the all singing, all dancing, I can hold a number, a string, a glob, or whistle Dixie implementation of the scalar interface. Okay? So what's our total derivation tree? And by the way, this, what you've just seen, is the deepest. This is the worst case. This is the deepest inheritance tree in Topaz that I have written so far and that I expect to see. It's from counted to value to scalar to final scalar to pool scalar to fat scalar. And actually, there's a bypass to thin scalar, which is the opposite of fat, which I'll get to in a sec. But that's pretty much it. That's the worst there will be. None of the other inheritance trees are probably going to be anywhere near that complicated. But the reason why it's like that is, of course, because scalar has been overloaded to do so many things. It does magic, it does fetching, it does overloading, it does numbers, it does strings, it sings, it dances, you know, it makes julienne fries, whatever they are. Okay, so that's the reason why scalar has so much complication. So, question there? Yes. I don't know. The question is, have I benefited in any way other than cleanness? In other words, is it faster? The answer is, I don't know. Actually, I expect the initial implementation to be noticeably slower because, you know, optimization is something that happens after it works. Yeah, rule number zero of optimization is don't optimize until you profile. Classic story on that. Some of you were in my XS talk. You heard this. Had a communications program once that downloaded events from monitoring boxes. And the events had year, month, day, hour, minute, second, and our database format was in time T's, you know, Unix time. And you'd figure with a communications program, with error checking the protocols, TTY manipulation and stuff, that would be the slow part. When we profiled, it turns out that the slowest part of the whole program was the MK time call. Because converting year, month, day, hour, minute, second to a time T is not a one-step process. It has to iteratively work its way down to the exact value because of the vagaries of time zones and daylight savings time and junk. So by changing our database format to year, month, day, hour, minute, second, we managed to make our program 50% faster. So, you know, until you profile, you don't know what's slow. And of course, until it runs, you can't profile. So I have no idea. I actually do expect it to be a bit slower because, if nothing else, we're reference counting stuff on the stack and we didn't used to. Fortunately, and I hate people who invoke this casually, but Moore's Law is our friend in this case. You know, Perl 5's guts were designed almost 10 years ago. And when you think about how much faster computers are over the last 10 years, some small decrease, and I do emphasize small because I'm not being casual about this, but some small decrease in efficiency, if it gains you reliability, if the improved structure of the code means that the bug count is fewer, smaller, and the number and the ease of fixing bugs is greater, if it means that you can add features that you would not have thought to add before and thus make the program more useful than it would have been, if you're gaining those benefits, then paying a little inefficiency is, I think, a good trade-off. And remember, just because Perl 6 exists does not mean that somebody's going to go around and delete Perl 5 from your hard drive. You know, if you like what Perl 5 does, it continues to live. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I need to do a good job, is because I'm competing with a very strong competitor. Say again, please. Well, he's saying history doesn't say that's true. It at least says that people will delay upgrading until they have a good reason. You know, it gets slower and slower. I mean, how long did it take people to upgrade from, say, SunOS to Solaris? You know, a lot of people say they upgraded from Solaris to SunOS 4, you know, because it was such a bad thing initially. So, yeah, I mean, if it's done, if it's complete, and if the chief Perl developers move over to Perl 6, then that means that the new stuff will tend to be there. On the other hand, even when the upgrade is a real improvement, like Perl 4 to Perl 5, Perl 4 still has not gone away. I can't believe people are still shipping systems with Perl 4 standard. You know, but they are. Irix still does that? Of course, Irix is going away. Maybe that's the reason. What? HPUX is still shipped with Perl 4. Somebody got to slap them around. Finally! Yes! And how long has it been? 8 years, right? So HPUX 11 is finally going to have Perl 5. But we don't know which 5. Oh, no. 5.01M, Larry says, probably, yeah. Okay, so it certainly is a concern. I don't at all, I mean, you know, at some point I might just, you know, shoot the thing myself if I discover that the performance is really bad. Again, like I said, that's one of the reasons why I'm calling it Topaz, not Perl 6. Yes, actually. The question is memory footprint, and I'm very conscious of that. I'll talk about that in a second. Okay. Everybody out of the scalar pool. Pool scalars are the subset of scalars that are, first of all, final, and second of all, small. That is, they have a fixed size, and they fit in that fixed size. The idea here is to have a pool of pool scalars, sort of like the pool of all SVs that currently exists in Perl 5. The thin scalar base class acts as sort of a non-abstract base class because you can instantiate it, but it never has anything in it but undef. But it's a convenient thing to use in a new statement to create a placeholder. Then it can be replaced with a thin string scalar, a thin integer scalar, or a thin ref scalar by a magical thing called transmogrification. Ooh. Scientific progress goes boink. thanks to the magic of transmogrification, the various pool scalars can transform one to another. And actually, that was another concern I had about Eiffel, is the difficulty of doing this. But fortunately, the C++ standard says that this is perfectly legal. Given the base address of the object, now that's a new syntax that ANSI supports, a dynamic cast on an object to type void star gives you guaranteed the base memory address of the most derived class that that object belongs to. In other words, it gives you the pointer that malloc returned. And that's especially important in the face of multiple inheritance, because sometimes the pointer to the object that you have is in the middle of the memory area that the object was allocated. So dynamic cast void star gives you the base address. And even if you didn't have ANSI C++, you could pretty much assume that this would work if you weren't doing multiple inheritance, which at the time, at this moment, we are not. Then you call the destructor by hand. You say, that object right there, kill yourself. Thwomp. Okay, so whatever kind of destructor things it does automatically happen. Then you call new, given that base address and the new class. And as long as the new class fits into the memory space occupied by the old one, and the placement new operator for pool scalars enforces that and throws an exception if you ever make a mistake on that, you've now transformed the object from one type to another in place. This is what allows us to not have a magic anymore. The fact that you can transform from one to the other, it also means that you don't need an SV type anymore, although we do still have a member function called type, but it's mostly for convenience in printing out, you know, what type you are when you use the when you print the debugging version of a reference, or you call the ref operator. All of the behavior can be implemented with vtables thanks to this sort of thing. So now talking about the memory footprint, I'm expecting the memory footprint of a thin scalar to be on a 32-bit machine, 16 bytes, 4 words. The first word is the vtable, of course. The second word would be the reference count. The third word would be flags. And the fourth word would be whatever you want it to be, depending on which particular thin scalar you have. So the fourth one would be, for example, the integer for an int scalar, or a pointer to the buffer structure for a string, or a pointer to the double for a numeric, or a pointer to the other SV for a reference. So this actually allows us to eliminate one level of indirection for all integer variables and for all reference variables. Because in Perl 5, the SV points to an any always. There's always an any structure. And that any structure for an integer just has an int. And for a reference, it just has a reference. And then that reference in turn points somewhere else. So you have to have the overhead of a malloc and a free for every reference you create and for every integer you create. And that will no longer be necessary. So I'm hoping to save on that. On the other hand, the base thing on the, what? Oh, that's right. They are in pools too. But at least does have to do the pointer and direction. I forgot that. Sorry. The pointer in direction, da-da-da. Okay, yeah, the base size is bigger, though. And I'm not sure whether that's a good trade-off. I think it'll be okay. The reason the base size is bigger is because instead of a type field, we have, of course, a VTable. So instead of three words on a 32-bit machine, we've got four words. So, you know, will that actually be a bad thing in practice? I think it'll be okay. The reason I think it'll be okay is because where you really feel the pain on the size of the base object is large data structures. If you want to have an array of 1,000 elements, that's 1,000 SV structures, and if the SV structure is 33% bigger than it used to be, that's going to hurt. On the other hand, one of the key things that should be very easy to do in Topaz is creating an array that's packed of a specific basic data type that is interesting to you. I think it's very important that if you say my num @array, internally that's implemented as a double star with just an array of doubles, and perhaps also an associated bit vector array to indicate which ones are undefined. Okay? And that is going to be much more of a benefit than a 33% increase in the size of the base object will be a detriment, I think, in real programs. So, you know, that's really where my thoughts are on that. Okay, so any other question? Yes? I'm sorry, say again? The question was, if you've just got an array of ints or an array of doubles, how do you handle aliasing for each loop? In other words, $_, I really should hook up my AC, it would stop hitting the screensaver. If you're in a for each loop, say you're iterating through the loop, $_ has to be an alias for the variable in the array. So when you say $_++, it increments it. Now obviously if every variable is always an SV, that's easy. $_'s SV part is just set to point to the very same one. But if there really isn't an SV there, you know, if there's no there, then how do you make the pointer? And the answer, of course, is a proxy class. There's going to have to be a proxy class, which means I am a stand-in for an array element. And internally, it will contain a pointer to the array and a numeric index. And when you assign to it, it just forwards the assignment to the array, which does a store, and that takes care of it. We need those anyway. You need already internally in Perl 5, and we continue to have the same need to have a proxy for a magic hash or a tied array. So it's just an extension of the same concept. It's kind of like if that didn't work, then we couldn't make tied arrays work either. Okay, question? Alrighty. So what happened to array and hash? Let's see, it's starting to move. Good. So what happened to array and hash? Well, I originally thought it would be really cool to have an array class with an interface that just used numeric indices and a hash class with an interface that just used keys. And by the way, completely separate issue, but I'm hoping to also support references as supported hash key types. Because I'm kind of tired of people trying to do that and it not working and you have to load an external module to simulate it, which kind of sucks. So, you know, references would be valid hash keys. So anyway, so you got the hash key interface and the integer index interface and never the main shell tweet. Well, unfortunately, it wasn't that simple. Thanks to the great inventiveness of, I think it was Graham who invented pseudo hashes? Who invented pseudo hashes? What? Oh, Malcolm. Malcolm Beatty, that's right. Malcolm invented pseudo hashes. For those of you who haven't used pseudo hashes, they're really cool. As a matter of fact, recently when I was actually writing Perl for money, as opposed to working on Perl for money, I was writing code that did a lot of database manipulation, and I found pseudo hashes to be very enticing and cool to use. It's one of the reasons why I had to install 5.5 on that machine. A pseudo hash is an array that can be treated like a hash. The short version is that if the first element of an array is a reference to a hash, and that hash contains keys which are field names and values which are indices, then if you treat that array like a hash, instead of causing an error, the Perl guts walk, find that index array, look up the field name, get the index, and then use that index to store or fetch into the base array that you started with. It actually, depending on how you declare things at compile time, can be an efficiency thing, because sometimes that transformation can be done at compile time. But whether or not it's done at compile time, it caused a problem for me. So that's a bad thing. On the other hand, it may have been good in the long term. The problem was this. I thought that pseudo hashes were a classic example of multiple inheritance at work. I mean, a pseudo hash is an array, and it's a hash. You know, it's a floor wax and a dessert topping. I thought it'd be great, right? In fact, I thought it'd be really even cool. There's a C++ feature I hadn't had a chance to use yet, which was virtual inheritance. And virtual inheritance is when you derive, you know, class A is derived from the base, and class B is derived from the base, but class C is derived from both A and B, but you only want one copy of the base class, right? So if array is a value, and that has a reference count, and hash is a value, and that is a reference count, then something which is both an array and a hash should only still have the one reference count. This is called diamond-shaped inheritance, a base class shared by the two derived classes, which both then are base classes of the final. Well, actually, virtual inheritance was a bad thing for efficiency, because most implementations require an extra pointer or two in the object, and that would have inflated the base object size from 16 to 20 or, you know, 24. Also, they make things slower, because you have to figure stuff out at runtime instead of compile time. And finally, the coup de grace didn't work. It didn't work because I had omitted a crucial, you know, I had committed one of the classic blunders. Most famous, of course, is never get involved in a land war in Asia. But only slightly less well known is, do not assume that you can know how an object will be used later unless you have a declaration when it's created. Yes, you can use any array as a pseudo hash. You don't have to declare it specially. You create the array, at the beginning of the program, it runs for 2 days. At the very end, you push an index hash onto the front, unshift it onto the front. Now you can use it as a pseudo hash. So that means the concept of knowing to create it as a pseudo hash from the beginning was right out the window. Any array could be used as a pseudo hash, even a tied array. I mean, that's pretty sick, but you could do it. Okay? So that means that the whole concept of separating the interfaces, that something would know that it's an array and it could never be used as a hash, I had to skip that. So actually, Joshua Pritikin had been pushing me to do this for a while. So I merged the interfaces, and it turned out actually to save a bit of code, because much of the interface of array and hash are quite similar. And pretty much it just ended up to be the same as before, except there were two fetches and two stores. And the default implementation of a hash-like fetch tries to do the array fetch and implement pseudo hashes. So although I don't have too much working right now, I do have pseudo hashes working as a proof of concept. So that actually turned out to simplify things. And in the process, I managed to get rid of the virtual and the multiple inheritance, and thus reduce the footprint of the base object. So, you know, everybody wins in the long term. Okay, question there? All right. Yes, that's an agger. Is that, I don't know, I keep thinking agate maybe, or aggressive, or something growling at you, or Tigger, yeah. Yeah, Tigger's brother is named Agger. What? Oh, yes, it's a hash and it's an array, so it's hairy. Yeah, well. And the implementation is, in fact, fairly hairy, so that could actually work. I think we'll stick. Larry says stick with Agger, yeah. Okay. I was kidding, yeah. Okay, user-created implementations. This is the thing I was alluding to at the beginning about a B-tree hash. The thing is that I've been describing the entire hierarchy as far as how the guts are implemented. But most of the internals of Topaz do not care about those various implementation classes, as of course it should be. For example, the array implementation. And it accepts a scalar as a value to store into an array element. It doesn't know what kind of scalar, and it doesn't care what kind of scalar is the value being stored. It just has a scalar start. So that means that you can implement your own. You know, implement your own array. Be the envy of your neighbors. So perhaps in an afternoon or a weekend, depending on how familiar you are with C++, you should be able to implement your own array or hash or so on. Now, the exact syntax for that is actually still kind of up in the air as far as I'm concerned. Larry may have a stronger idea, and I just don't understand it yet. Or perhaps Larry doesn't understand it. Yes, I mean, rule number one is that Larry's always right, but you must remember the rule number two is when Larry changes his mind, see rule number one. So it will be something like this, however. You should be able to simply use B-tree hash, and that, of course, would be the class name that you've created. In that class, we would have a method presumably called prepare, which is a name that is based on some recent work that Ilya's done. And the prepare function will be automatically called by Perl when the my declaration is executed. B-tree hash, colon, colon, prepare. and you will be passed a reference, and of course all these details are subject to change, but the concept is there. Prepare will be called with a reference to this percent %H, which will be then free for you to replace with a C++ object of your creation. And that C++ object will then implement the entire interface of hash in whatever way you think is useful. And of course, no change to the guts of Perl, neither any relinking of Perl will be necessary for you to do this. So this will allow all kinds of interesting experimentation to take place. I'm hoping that it'll have a similar effect on people who want to do cool stuff with data structures that the implementation of extensions did for people who wanted to add on support for third-party libraries. Okay, question there?
I still like there. Why is this different than my main read hack percent %H, the different syntax?
Well, the question was, why not simply say my btree hash percent %H? If it was a scalar, actually still the same issue comes up. The problem is this. What if you wanted to leave room in the language to say, this is a hash whose values are all btree hash pointers? Right? That's what that syntax would presumably mean based on what we are guessing at this point. Yeah.
You might want to say my dog percent.
There you go. You want to have my dog percent pound, right? All the dogs in the pound, but you'd implement the pound as a btree hash, right? So the btree hash goes to the right and the dog goes to the left. So that's the idea. Again, we are kind of making this up as we go along. Okay, another question there? Okay, your turn. Yes. So I don't know, we may be done early, but at this point, any questions? And it may not necessarily be on Topaz, but maybe on existing Perl 5 stuff. Yeah. Yeah, we are using templates, but you're right, we've avoided multiple inheritance so far. No. Okay, the question is whether we're using STL. First of all, do you mean the actual STL or the C++ standard library, which includes STL?
I was thinking
just the STL part. So far, made very minimal use of the STL. You know, it's kind of a hard thing to know which parts of STL are really appropriate to use. Like, for example, trying to turn array into an STL container. You know, I've thought about doing it, but then I also thought, you know, why? So I'm not really sure. Turning the iterators, like the hash iterators, into a classic STL iterator. You know, it's possible that would be a good thing to do. It's possible that people writing the third-party stuff might find that useful. But you're right. I'm not depending on it very much. Partly it's by force, because like I say, I'm compiling with EGCS, and EGCS's library is not the best yet. Hand was up before.
Yeah, I have a comment on that. STL library implementations vary widely in quality and performance and stuff. For all the reasons that Perl 5 no longer uses your system, bring them. I think it might be a bad idea.
Well, except for security, yeah. Actually, now that I think about it, though, STL really has helped me in one way. I'm using an STL map as the current implementation of fat hash, and an STL, I'm using an STL vector as the current implementation of fat array. I don't think that'll stand, but it was very helpful for me as a prototyping tool. I can't hear you. That's correct. The question was, I'm not making wide use of templates as the general aggregate, as the general way to build aggregates in the internals. And the answer is that's correct, I'm not, because I want a little better control over this. I mean, it seems to me like the STL is really optimized for people who are using C++ as their applications language. You know, they just want to map. They don't care if it's, you know, 10K or 20K. They'll just use it, and then, you know, it goes away. It's kind of like the same reasons people would use Perl. You know, it's bigger, but it's more convenient. On the other hand, when you actually want to know how big it is and control the hashing algorithm and so on, you really can't use STL, not easily anyway. Yep. Behind. Yep. Oh, yes, yes. The question was, has it been rewarding separating scalar and the other classes into that sort of hierarchy? And the answer is yes. I really have appreciated the results. In particular, I did not anticipate the role of final scalar. That just sort of fell out, because after you carefully define the interface of a scalar that you want, and then you go down to the tied scalar case, and then you try to implement things like, what type are you? And then you realize, well, that question doesn't make any sense. They say, oh, well, then that must actually not be part of this interface. And so you, then you move the interfaces around. And so that it's kind of like how, you know, when novelists talk about how their characters by the middle of the novel are starting to surprise them, you know, because they've got an internal model of the character and they don't really understand it so well as they think they do. And then it does something surprising. Well, actually, Topaz has been like a novel in two ways. One is it surprised me from time to time. And that was a real rewarding surprise. And the other is that I had to write it to get it out of my head. Larry will tell you, I'd been bugging him for a year before the conference last year about wanting to do this, and he was kind of like noncommittal. You know, he was kind of like, well, maybe it'll go away, I suppose. And I would have liked to have it go away in some ways, but it just wouldn't go away until I wrote it down. So there we are. Okay, I'll be next.
So what have you got written down?
What is written? Good question. Those are the current classes I've got. You can see that a lot of them are the scalar things. You got the hash, the array, the globs. There's an underlying buffer class, which is actually kind of cool. It takes advantage of reference counting. It has a reference counted internal structure so that copying a buffer is a very cheap operation. So the buffer class is equivalent to, you know, an allocated memory area, and it can be returned by value at very low cost. Simplified the interface in a lot of ways. It also is capable, on the other hand, of referring to foreign memory. So you don't have to have allocated memory to make a buffer, which is really good. You know, when you're doing design like this, it's helpful to have a few corner cases in mind. One, of course, is that the most common case must always be fast. But then there's the tied scalar is one corner case, because when you're fetching a value, that value does not exist at the time, right? So you can't depend on an interface that says something like, please give me a pointer into your internal buffer, because you don't have one, right? So that's one corner case. The other corner case, on the other hand, is a shared memory scalar. You should be able to create a shared memory scalar and then at minimal overhead be able to do things like apply a regular expression to it without copying it. So in one case, you must make a copy because there is no original. In the other case, you don't want to make a copy because it's too big. So what kind of interface supports that? Well, it just so happens that what I've got so far, and by the way, it's not fully implemented, so who knows, I might have to change it. Is it final? I think a final scalar has it. Where is that? Where did I put that? Maybe this scalar. Yeah, here it is. There's a class called OpenBuffer and OpenMemory, and that's actually a holdover from when buffers couldn't refer to foreign memory. So in the future, it's just going to be OpenBuffer. If you instantiate an OpenBuffer object, that calls the virtual functions there at the bottom of the screen, the virtual function OpenBuffer. And that will either give you a buffer that points at your big virtual memory area at zero copying cost, or it will call the fetch operation on your tied scalar and then have a copy of it, which it gives to you, which you are then free to delete when you're done. The decision of whether you have to do a delete when you're done is kept in an internal state in the open buffer object. So simply by instantiating an open buffer, you now have a pointer into something which can be scanned, which will either be cheap or only as expensive as necessary. So the idea here is that, for example, if you are doing an index call into a shared memory area, then eventually when you get way down to the bottom, the little pointer loop that says, what am I looking for, should actually be pointing at the shared memory area when it scans it. So that's the intention. Yep. Yeah, opcodes, absolutely. That's a subject that deserves its own discussion, so I want to get two people who had their hands up before. Yeah? CPAN extensions. I intend to make a C linkage compatibility layer that will allow existing XSub source code to run. Things that used to be macros won't be anymore. And so, you know, SVIV obviously isn't a macro anymore. So things might be, you know, they'll be even slower for an XS than they would be if they were translated. But they should work. So that's the intention. OK, somebody else had their hand up before? Yeah.
I probably didn't write it in the higher expression, which is I'm certain that it will take
Yeah, the question is the B module, how much of that will I be supporting? And the answer is absolutely none. That module will be going away. It is doomed. It will be no more. It shall cease to be. It will be an X module. There's really no help for that. You can't do a reimplementation without breaking code that has deliberately and with malice aforethought decided that it wants to look at every single bit and every single field, you know, which the compiler does. On the other hand, the things that the compiler does will be implementable in a so much more clean and easy fashion that I don't think even the current maintainer of the B modules will really be upset about it. Anything having to do with compilation and compilation backends is doomed. If, of course, this turns out to be Perl 6. If, on the other hand, I get, you know, hit by a bus tomorrow, then, you know, they might be useful for another 5 years.
So what?
Okay, that does get into Larry's thing. So I'll come back to that. Okay, had a hand in back. Lexical I/O handles. Perl 5, yes. Well, that's mostly a language design issue, but I already did ask an earlier question that's probably close enough. The earlier question I asked Larry is, could we finally please have a lexical glob, my star A? And he said, oh, okay. So given a lexical glob, which of course contains a file handle, and given the fact that open operator now will auto-vivify a variable as its first parameter, which I don't know if you've seen that yet, that in the release notes for 5.6, have you put it in the release notes already? Yeah, in the changes file. You can now say open my $a, comma, something, 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 and my $a will of course be declared by the my. It'll initially be undef, but then the open operator looks and sees that's an undef. It auto-vivifies it with a reference to a glob and then uses that for the open. And then of course, because it's a my $a, when the scope is departed, the reference count falls to zero, the IO is freed and it's automatically closed. So that has all the convenience of what a lexical file handle would be. So, you know, that's close enough, I think. Except for the dollar signs instead of some other punctuation mark, which, you know, I still am bitter about, but that's okay. Okay, yes, one more. Lexical subroutines will be implemented. My sub foo, which is actually tied in, and I might actually make it into Perl 5 before I'm done. 5.6 even, really? It can happen. Yeah, it can happen. You're in Judy Tenuta mode. Okay, so getting back to the opcodes. Actually, the opcodes have been on my mind for a while, and it's been very painful. But let's see, a lot of this is actually leftovers. Creator, I think the creator stuff is obsolete now. I've been working on it very recently. Let's see here. No, that stuff isn't. Okay, first of all, inside of the op class is this nested class called info. Let's see here. For those of you who are not quite sure about nested classes, it's just mostly a naming convention. I didn't want to call it an op info. I wanted to call it an op colon colon info. I think it's a little clearer. Otherwise, that struct could just be put outside. Anyway, the op info structure, as you can see, is a plain old data, a pod in the C++ standard terms. This means that you can initialize it using the C syntax. My expectation is that an array of const op infos will be exactly corresponding to what is now a statically allocated const array for op names, op descriptions, op flags, and so on. So one single initialization list will be created by the equivalent of opcode.pl, and it will describe their names, their descriptions, their prototypes in the $@ fashion. Their types, I forget what the op type is. What was an op type? Unary, binary, list, or non-ary. And its creation function and its thawing function. And the thawing function works with the freezing function, which I'm not sure if I put in the interface here yet. No, I didn't. The idea here is that each op object will know how to save itself to an arbitrary I/O stream, and it will know how to restore itself from the I/O stream. This will be the bytecode compilation interface. So when you create an op, it will know how to save itself and how to restore itself. So in order to do bytecode compilation, all you have to do is build a whole op tree and then tell the top level op, save yourself. And it knows how to call its children and say, save yourselves. You open the file, say, do it. And now you've got a bytecode output. So that's the plan. Opcodes go into a pool. Opcodes have an operator new. Where is that? There you go. Opcode operator new and opcode operator delete go into a an obstack, which is actually named after the GNU memory pool thing. And every user code, every user defined function has an obstack attached, and all the ops for that user code go into that obstack. And an obstack is basically a bunch of allocated areas in which the ops accumulate. And so to free them, you basically have to call free, you know, 5 times instead of 500. So does that answer your question? Absolutely. Yeah, the thing is that right now we're still calling delete, we're still calling the destructor on all those ops, but some ops don't need that. So the idea is eventually to have a registry of which ops, you know, an op can decide when it's created, do I actually need to be destroyed or is there no point? But there's no reference counting on the ops, and certainly you don't have to call free and malloc on each one. An op knows how to fold itself, an op knows how to optimize itself, and an op knows how to return an info structure describing itself. That's how you find out its name and its description. Notice that there is no op code. There is no numeric op code. This is a very important decision because it means that we do not have to worry about allocating globally unique opcodes in order to have byte compilation work. Opcodes will be known by their names. Their names must be short in order for the bytecodes not to be inflated. And it's possible that we'll actually have two different names, one which is human readable and the other which is intended for bytecode purposes. But it's a very important thing not to expect that we can have a globally unique numeric allocation scheme. I don't think that's a wise idea. I think that would be doomed. Because if I modify my Perl and you modify your Perl, we both modify our Perls to include a new opcode, and it's both number 72. I try to read your binary code that's been byte compiled. You know, I want to know that that number 72 is not something I recognize. I don't want to be fooled into thinking that that's going to run. So that's the intention. Say again, please. There's still no guarantee, but the point is the names are a lot easier to disambiguate the numbers by using a prefix. It's the same thing like module names. I mean, what if we had no module names, only module numbers? Yeah, so naming is better. It's not a panacea, but at least it allows a robust approach. Say again, please. Yeah. That's true. You could just use numbers instead of names, but you know, when we talk about user-created opcodes, we must remember that one of the users is in fact P5P. We're going to have evolution of Perl as it goes on, and we don't want to assume that that we have a fixed set of numbers and that won't change except by individual users tinkering. So it's really the same problem. You know, especially when we, for example, have a fork, right? You know, Perl 6.0 versus Perl 6.2, and that could be a real mess. So. On the other hand, the actual implementation in the file could include something like a symbol table, where up front we could have a list of all the actual opcode names and their corresponding numbers, because maybe numbers would be a more efficient file representation. But semantically, they're all names. Such numbers would be strictly within a given file. They wouldn't be global. Let's see here. What was the other thing? Okay, right now we've got a run method, and that's just so that I can do the minimal testing, which I hope I have running binaries right here. Let's see. No, sure don't. I hope I didn't break my EGCS installation before I came here. Well, afraid I did. Well, that really sucks. Actually, that's kind of a weird error. Let me take a look at that. Oh, man, it's that stupid standard namespace thing again. I should have fixed this before I came here. Anyway, I'll tell you what would have happened. I do have a test ops driver, which basically does a start compilation on the interpreter object, which does at least minimally exist at this point. A Perl :: interpreter object corresponds pretty closely to the Perl structure that currently exists when you compile with multiplicity. It allows you to have multiple interpreters running in the same memory space. Anyway, and yes, there will be an optimization for when you're doing a standalone Perl and there's just one global one. So the interpreter object, if you tell it you're going to start a compilation, it allocates a user code object to say this is the new subroutine I'm building. And within the user code is an arena for the allocation of the ops for that subroutine. Have to do that because of the way the memory management works. Then we create an op list consisting of the const op with the thin string scalar hello world. The PL stir thing is a little hack that has to do with the typing of a quoted string. It's not really very significant. Then a new print op is created, taking that kids list, that list of parameters as its parameter in the creation, and then we call run on the print. And in fact, when my compiler works, it prints hello world. So that much works. The trick is that the run operation built into an op is doomed. There's not going to be one in the final implementation. Because one of the problems with op trees is that they're a fairly inefficient way of representing runtime behavior. Because they also include pointers and other information that's really only used to compile time to decide what should happen, as opposed to runtime, what will happen. So I'm intending to separate building the op tree from building a runtime representation. The runtime representation should be very tight. It should be something that more resembles a fourth runtime than anything else, threaded interpreting. And that should allow us to have a very small memory buffer. Now, is it worth it to also delete the op tree? Well, probably it's not worth it to delete the op tree for the main code in a large program, but certainly it's a good idea to minimize the memory used when you have lots and lots of modules that you're loading. So that may actually be a place where a pragma like use less memory comes in, but I'm not really sure. In any case, it's important to separate that, I think, because having the op both have things like what's a list of my children and also what is the pointer to the next one at runtime, I don't think has scaled to the size of program that people want to use Perl for these days. Although obviously it was a good thing at the time. Okay, yes? Yeah, the question is, what about turning off various features of Perl or eliminating them temporarily? And the answer is, it seems like a good idea in concept, it's just that when people get down to particulars, it usually ends up to be such a small set that it's not worth doing. And I'm not trying to be flippant about it, it just really is deceptive when you look at it with human intuition. Especially if you try to add up all the bytes that you'd save, it typically is very little. But we're certainly open to any observations about things that really can be cut out. I was hoping, for example, to get rid of formats. I think that'd be really cool, but I don't think we can really do that yet. His hand was up first. Yeah?
Yeah. What about
modifying the syntax tree at runtime? No. I think that's fairly evil. And although some people are apparently doing that, I'd have to suggest that there are more orthodox ways of accomplishing the same goals. And I'd rather not go out of my way to implement something like that. I mean, if it works by accident, great. But, you know, I don't think so. Yeah, could you give a specific example? Something you've seen done?
Probably not right now.
No, okay. Can deep parse not only looks at the opcodes but actually can modify them in place? Okay, you're talking about building them, not modifying them. I suppose you could. I mean, I suppose you could like reach into the, you know, the assignment op and turn it into a no op or something like that. Yeah. Actually, building an op tree sounds like a kind of a cool thing to do. But as far as modifying one that's in place, you know, self-modifying code is bad enough at the machine level. You know, self. No, they're talking about modifying it on purpose, not because you have to. But there were apparently a lot of things that got modified in the op tree at runtime in Perl 4, which are now part of the scratch pad in Perl 5. So if anything, the trend is toward making the op tree less malleable. And I hope to continue that. Okay, there was another hand up. Yep. Well, tying is an inherently expensive way to implement new semantics, but I think the dynamically loading of implementations, I think, will take care of that for the cases where the efficiency is a problem. I mean, if you wanted to do a B-tree hash before, you would have had to do it as a tie. And so if you do it native, it's a lot better. Okay, so method call overhead. Yeah, actually, we're already working that on Perl 5.6. There's already a new opcode for method lookup that is a constant string that's known, and the hash on it is pre-computed. And I'm not sure how much of an impact that's had, but we're already looking at that, so. Oh, okay, you talk to me. Talk to me a minute. Okay, so any other questions? Yeah. Multi-threading. Dagnabbit, I forgot to put that on the slide. Yeah, it's my opinion that the current experiment with threading in Perl 5 has shown that it's really not a good idea to have more than one thread in an interpreter at a time. And so I'm taking as a base design decision not to do that. Now, still, obviously, it's a good idea to share data. So the idea is to have a separate derived class from scalar, which would be a shared scalar, that has knowledge of interlocks and so on. And there'd be also a shared array and a shared hash. Shared hashes would only allow shared data in them. Then, since they have the interlocks, shared hashes and shared scalars and so on could live in the symbol table of more than one running interpreter at a time. So running interpreter A, one thread. Running interpreter B, one thread. In between them, a single shared data structure, perhaps even a shared package containing shared data. And those data could be examined from both sides. They would pay the cost for the interlocks and the semaphores. They would pay the cost of the semaphores. Meanwhile, the rest of the interpreter could run freely. There's so much shared data that has to be constantly available in a Perl interpreter that putting proper locks on all of it is not feasible, and even the current implementation doesn't try to. The current implementation, therefore, by not putting locks everywhere they're needed, has decided to let the users dump core. And I personally think that in Perl, that's not a good thing to do. I don't think it should be possible for a Perl user to dump core unless he overflows the stack or uses unpack with P. You know, other than that, no. So. Yeah, you pretty much do, unless you can provide it in the pseudo command line arguments of the newly created interpreter. But putting it in a shared data structure may not be such an issue. If it's a big data structure, it's probably a global variable anyway. So all you have to do is declare it as a shared package, and you're off and running. So not a big deal. Okay, well, I'm losing my audience, and I see my time is up. So thank you for your participation.